Good evening and welcome to KVC Arts, a program dedicated to arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, music and conversation with Stray Cat Lee Rocker, performing at the historic Hemet Theater. John Sheldon gives us more on Through Wonderland, an adaptation of Alice in Wonderland, running through December 8th at Crafton Hills College. Also, Ron Burgless speaks with Paul Jacques about some seasonal theater in the area. Ron also spoke with Elena Villa, director of the Citrus Valley High School Performing Arts Department and the Black Hawk Theater Company in Redlands.
So what constitutes a successful production in your eyes?
Well, in educational theater, I think it's a little bit different than in for-profit or even community theater. A successful production is when the students, both crew and cast, really come out of it having felt that they've learned something, that they've grown, possibly done something that they've never done before, or never thought they could do before. And what can we do to improve that in the future? We do two types of shows in honor production. One of our additional expectations is that we have put on a show that is great, not great for high school, just a great show, period.
What about the audience response, the audience attendance? Do you get a big audience? Because how many people still go to theater?
That's a great question and something that I think anybody who does theater is challenged by. For Spamalot, we were very pleased. We had consistent audiences every night from opening to closing. We ran two weekends. So we had about 150 to 200 every night. So it was a really great crowd.
You know, I saw the show and I was struck by how great the kids collaborated, how enthusiastic mm-hmm. they were, how well they worked together, not just the people that were on stage, but the people backstage. Mm-hmm. I saw that you gave the crew a curtain call, which is unusual. Mm-hmm. How do you make that happen?
I could not do it without the additional people on our staff that work with me, and that's our musical director for this show is our choir teacher, Kim Taylor, and she's incredible to work with. And I also have an incredible costumer that's worked with me since I was at a previous school, Sharon Leeper. So without her and our lighting designer and our shop manager, Jennifer Vincent, so without those people, I could not be everywhere at once. So they help get the students to understand how we collaborate as adults, how we get our job done, and then how we disseminate that to the kids. And it doesn't always go perfectly, but that's why it's educational theater. So we're able to teach them as we go.
Speaking of teaching, you teach classes there as well as direct.
I do.
So what do you teach?
I teach two periods of beginning theater. So those are for students who've maybe never taken a theater class in their life before. Also for students who may be interested in taking theater in the future. I also teach intermediate theater, which is an audition class, and that's for kids who have taken theater before and want to continue to have fun with that. And then I teach an advanced theater class, which is really geared towards kids who know that they want to do theater arts post high school, whether that be continuing to do it in the community theater setting or doing it at a college.
So do you sleep and live at the theater as well?
There is a joke about that, as I'm sure there is for most teachers in general. We do spend a lot of time there. We're there a lot of Saturdays. We do field trips, but I love it. It's what my husband does. It's what I do. And we love being there, and I can bring my son there. So it's lovely.
Well, let's go back a bit. Where did you grow up, and when did you decide you wanted to teach and teach theater?
I grew up in Pomona, California, so not too far from here. I went to Gary High School. I took one beginning theater class in high school, but other than that, I was a jock. I ran cross country, and I ran track, and I played club soccer, and I really didn't give theater a second thought when I was in high school. College is when I discovered theater. We did Godspell. And there I was, having never been in a musical or really been in a show, and it kind of took off from there. And we did Twelfth Night, and then we did a Women of Broadway, a compilation of Broadway songs. And I was already in the credentialing program at the time, and that was kind of it. It was a place where you could let your day go and just play and be somebody else for a while. And I saw how happy it made people. And I thought, well, when I get my credential, I'm going to try and find a job teaching theater.
So no desire to carry on acting. You were specifically wanted to teach.
You know, I wanted to be in and around theater. I just wanted to do that. It didn't catapult me into wanting to stay in LA and have a career. That wasn't what it drove me to do, but I just loved how being in the theater made me feel. It was fun. It was just fun.
So you graduate from Mount St. Mary's. Mm-hmm. You want to teach. Mm-hmm. You want to teach theater.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard. It must be hard to get a job teaching theater. Schools, districts are mm-hmm. cutting back theater programs all over the country. How do you get your first job?
asking. This is so funny because I think of all the little things that happen that people don't know that they have actually contributed to where I am now. But I think back, I graduated in May. I was 21 and I had a job in August. And I went into the job telling them, nope, I don't have a degree in theater. I've done 3 shows in my life. I don't know anything about how to do technical theater, but by gosh darn it, I am going to work hard and I'm going to be the best theater teacher. And I think it was my bright-eyed optimism that won over the principal that was there at the time. And I have no idea why. They had no obligation to give me this job, but they gave me the job. And it was part-time teaching English and part-time teaching theater. And that's how I started.
And you went on to direct a program at a school in Riverside, is that right? Which school was that? How long ago?
Arlington High School. I was there for 10 years. So that was my first job out of college. I had that job for 10 years until I moved over to Citrus Valley.
And I've also been told that you've done some work at Redlands Bowl as well.
Yes. In between the time that I was teaching, when I met Ron,
That's a really good name, by the way.
It's a great name. I know you like that name. He encouraged me, and he was involved in being a performer himself. He also wrote and directed, and so he was involved with doing a show at a dinner theater, and so I did that, and then eventually he started getting involved with the Redlands Bowl, where they do the Redlands Shakespeare Festival, which is a fabulous event every year, and he encouraged me to audition. And I thought, there's no way with all of my teaching. But I did do a show there and then have helped out with various shows in various ways. But yeah, it's been great, and done some additional dinner theater and some community theater work.
And eventually you wound up at Citrus.
And eventually I wound up at Citrus.
Tell me something. What reason have you got to give the kids for why they should take theater? I mean, it's very few of them will go on.
Sure.
Even fewer will be successful. Mm-hmm. So how do you rationalize teaching them how to act and do theater?
It's what I teach my beginning theater kids, because they often ask that question. I have them raise their hand. Who's taking this class because their counselor told them they needed an arts credit? And I said, be honest, it's okay, it doesn't hurt my feelings. And so there's a variety of kids, some that want to take the class, some that ended up in my class. And what I always say to them is, my goal is to teach you to be a better communicator, to teach you to be a better collaborator, to teach you to be thoughtful and kind towards others' feelings and opinions, because all of those things are what are required in order to create great theater. So yes, you're going to learn about this art form, but at the end of the day, I don't think you're going to necessarily remember all the terms, but I want you to take away these life skills that I think are essential to being a great human being, and also to having any job. In any job, there are people that you have to collaborate with. You have to think critically. You have to be creative. So those are the skills that they can take with them regardless of what they're doing.
And you're trying all kinds of other things in that department. You're trying to form a nonprofit. You're trying to get business sponsorship. Mm-hmm. You've got great plans.
Yes.
How do you propose to form a nonprofit? How are you going to do that?
I've had the help of many people, including yourself, in getting parents involved. And I can't do that without parent involvement. So I've been very fortunate and continue to seek parents to help form that nonprofit. It requires a great deal of paperwork and other things, but I think having other schools to look at that have theater boosters will give us the chance to follow their roadmap. We do a pre-show ad somewhat like you'd see in a movie theater, where we have a screen and a projector and we show color ads that can include any sort of information or animation that a business might want. And we run that for over 3,000 people, because if we add up our season, our number of shows, plus our comedy sports, which is our competitive improv team, they do a show a month. So we are running our ads before all of those shows. It's an opportunity for a business to reach all of those people, plus to support a growing program.
Tell me about your plans in the last few minutes we've got here. Tell me about your plans for the future, the season coming up.
We have our winter showcase that highlights all of our classes. So our beginning kids get their first chance to perform in front of an audience, our intermediate kids, and our advanced kids as well. And then we'll be doing our honor production, which is Merchant of Venice, but we'll be doing it in the Commedia style. And that will be directed by Ron Miltz, our guest director. And then we move on to our musical, which is Seussical. We'll be incorporating elementary school students for that show. And that'll be a wonderful opportunity for them.
Why would you be doing Merchant of Venice Commedia style?
It was actually originally done, Ron originally did it at the Bowl when he did the cutting of the script specifically for that production. It was a show that we worked on quite a bit together at home, discussing how we would do it, the approach, how the Commedia helped actually tell the story in a better way. And when we were discussing what show we wanted to include in this season, he thought it was a great idea, as did I. So he will be coming in to do that. and we're hoping to have it adjudicated for the International Thespian Festival in June. And that means we would get to take it out there and have the kids perform there. So we're excited about that.
You're involved in a lot of different theater organizations and competitions.
I am. You get the kids
everywhere.
We try to get them lots of exposure, especially the kids who want to go into colleges and universities. We want to get them scholarships. We want to get them some rankings on their resume at different festivals and competitions. And we want to try and get them some scholarship money and get some college interest in them.
So if a business wants to sponsor a show or shows, who do they contact?
So they can contact the Black Hawk Theater Company, theater with an R-E, at gmail.com, and I can send them information. They can also visit our website, which is accessed through the Citrus Valley High School website. But Black Hawk Theater Company at gmail.com is a great place to start, quick and easy.
Well, thank you very, very much for coming in.
Thanks, Ron.
That was Ron Berglas in conversation with Elena Villa. Ron also spoke with Paul Jacques, a name that may be familiar to some, about some regional, seasonal theater coming up soon. John Sheldon gives us more on Through Wonderland, in performance at Crafton Hills College through Sunday. Also, music and conversation with Stray Cat Lee Rocker. That's all just ahead.
This is 91.9 KVCR. I'm Jessica James with a look at what's going on in our region. It's bilingual story time for children of all ages at the A.K. Smiley Public Library in Redlands, with stories in both English and Spanish. Story time is at 10:15 to 10:45 Saturday mornings. It's the Loma Linda Farmers Market, most Sunday mornings from 8 till noon. The Farmers Market is located on the Barton Frontage Road between Loma Linda Drive and Benton Street, just across Barton Road from the Stater Brothers Shopping Center. And it's Village Fest every Thursday evening in the heart of downtown Palm Springs. Each block offering street entertainment, art, handicraft items, food, and more. And along with that, enjoy free admission to the Palm Springs Art Museum every Thursday, 4 to 8 p.m. during the downtown Village Fest. Free admission is also offered on the second Sunday of each month. This is 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcr.org.
I'm David Fleming with you for KVC Arts. Later, it's music and conversation with Stray Cat Lee Rocker. Ron Berglas speaks with Paul Jacques about some seasonal theater in the area. First, though, John Sheldon recently spoke with Lucas Manning and Jessica Ackerson about Through Wonderland, in performance at Crafton Hills College through Sunday.
As a former student, I'd like to say it's really cool to be able to come out and actually promote stuff for Crafton.
Absolutely, and we really appreciate you doing it.
Share with us a little about yourself.
Okay, my name's Jessica Ackerson, and I'm a student at Crafton Hills College. I also am an assistant manager at a bookstore in Redlands called The Frugal Frigate, a children's bookstore.
My name's Lucas Manning. I'm a student at University of Redlands, Go Bulldogs. I'm a previous student at Crafton Hills College, and now I'm actually adjunct faculty. I teach a hip-hop dance class. I danced professionally from around 18 to about 24 years old, and now I'm trying to share that with the Inland Empire a little bit.
What is your position in the theater department or as a theater student entail?
During this particular project, Lucas and I are co-writers and co-directors. Built this whole project from the ground up. We're lucky enough to be at a department at Crafton Hills College that allows a lot of student creativity, and student participation.
Absolutely. In the past, I've directed dance shows for the Crafton Hills Theater Department, and this particular time, I approached the department head, Tom Bryant, and told him of a small idea I had to do slightly bigger dance-based production. And after talking with him and with his support, I got a hold of Jessica, who has much more of a theatrical background than I do. And we began to piece the show together, as she said, piece by piece and from the ground up.
Now, before we go into Through Wonderland, what were some of your more successful projects at Crafton or even at another theater?
I got the opportunity to co-direct the Laramie Project. I also directed Rabbit Hole. Both of those were at Crafton Hills College and were a huge success, so I was very lucky in that.
I started with the Redlands Festival Ballet Company based in Redlands, California, as a corps de ballet and worked my way up to a soloist. At 18, I moved over to Salt Lake City, Utah, and there I received my first professional job working in the corps de ballet for Utah Opera and Symphony. From then on, I did a bunch of various gigs. I've done some TV and television work for Disney. I've done concerts, and of course, I've done as much musical theater as I can get my hands on. When I decided to go back to school and come back to the Inland Empire, I was introduced once again to the Crafton Hills Theater Department. And at that point, I began choreographing for their shows as well as the University of Redlands, and soon found myself choreographing for such shows as Rent, for Cozy Von Toot, really just enjoying the entire environment in this particular area.
Tell us a little about Through Wonderland. What's unique about this particular show?
Well, we are calling it a dance production with a narrative. And what that means is we wanted to portray Alice's adventure through Wonderland and all the characters she meets there as a coming-of-age story, and we wanted to focus on that. And the theme is, can Alice find her voice through Wonderland? It's been a lot of fun, and it is very unique in the fact that it is a dance show and a theater show, so we're kind of appealing to both worlds.
Yes, we're really trying to pull both from Jessica's theater experience, my dance experience, to come up with something that we consider to be spectacular and truly original. The entire idea for the show really came out of this desire to do a children's production for the Crafton Hills College, which we don't typically do. And so from that desire, again, I began working with Jessica, and we began to piece this together. And we've ended up finding some really unique things around the way. You know, whenever you do a show, you end up discovering things about the character that you may not have thought so before. And we really discovered that Alice's character is this child who's really trying to come into their own. And as she is, she's encountering all these different characters who are both surreal and absurd. And through her interactions with these characters, as Jessica said, she begins to find a sense of what we would call a voice, individuality, and becomes her own person throughout her adventures in Wonderland. We have some surprises in store for the show. We have a 9-foot Cheshire cat that will be making an appearance at some point in the show. Also, we've done some really unique things with trying to bring the characters forth in a new and interesting way. We've set every single particular scene in a different time era, and using this idea has affected our music, our costume choice, and how the characters end up interacting with Alice. The overall goal is, of course, that every single character reveals some sort of lesson, even malevolent lessons at times, that really explain to Alice what does it actually mean to be in the real world, to discover your own voice, what kind of adversities will you face, and what kind of people will you face along the way.
Wow, that's quite a bit of lesson learning there throughout the whole show. And I talked to Tom Bryant earlier, and you said that it was family-friendly.
Yes, it is family-friendly. Yeah. Actually, on the last performance, all the proceeds will be donated to the local children's hospital.
Can you explain why you chose this production, like the philosophy behind it, how you generated thoughts about how and what to actually present in the play?
Well, absolutely, John. I am, as a student, both a mathematics and a philosophy major, which brings me somewhat closer, I feel, to Lewis Carroll's world of logic, absurdity, surrealism. And so I've always been fascinated with the tale of Alice and her adventures through Wonderland, as long as I can remember. With recent light being brought and the attention being brought to new productions of fairy tales. So we see a lot of on TV right now rehashing a lot of the old stories in new and original ways. And I was really inspired by this idea. That combined with my desire to really bring something that was family friendly to the Crafton Hills College Theater, that was really my push in getting this show to happen. As far as the philosophy goes, again, we've really gone over a lot of what we feel Alice is trying to discover throughout the show. We really do play up the absurdism, and I don't really think you can do Alice in Wonderland without playing with the idea of absurdism, which is one of my personal favorite types of philosophy. So I would say the absurdist aspect would be the driving force in this show, but to bring us to a particular point.
And Jessica, what about you? What was the philosophy you brought into this?
There's children all around us all the time, and we need to show them that you're growing up and there are stories out there that can help you along the way, and we're going to bring that to life for you in a very spectacular sort of way. Every rehearsal, every meeting we've had, not only shown me the coming-of-age story attribute to this, but, I mean, it's just a life story. We're constantly learning every day of our lives, and we can really take from Alice and what she learns on her adventure.
I would describe it as the fantastically paranoid. There's always a certain aspect of reality through the absurdism, but it's the absurdism that makes us laugh, makes us cry, makes us feel for the characters and the frustration she feels as she's going through this unknown world.
And that really relates to a child and their story of growing up and learning their lessons of and the consequences of whatever action, whether they're good or bad, but right. learning the consequences of their actions.
Absolutely.
It applies to everyone, not only children.
People still learn those lessons today.
Absolutely.
I'm learning them all the time.
Every day.
Is there anything you'd like to say about the crew or the cast, choreographers?
Oh, absolutely. We are so lucky to have a wonderful cast. We have a cast of 25 dancers and actors. Everybody dances, everybody acts. We made that very clear in the beginning, so there's no separation. Some main people we want to highlight in the show is our Alice, and she's being played by Arielle Bell. And then our Queen of Hearts will be played by Tamara Stair. And our White Rabbit is played by Brendan Hampton. And our Mad Hatter is played by Benjamin Parker. Also, we are doing a fundraising campaign on Booster.com. You can go online and you can help support us by buying one of our Through Wonderland t-shirts.
Excellent. And then from my end, as far as the choreographers go, I was very, very fortunate to be able to call in some old favors with some old friends of mine who still dance professionally. Among the two that I'd like to highlight, there is Gev Manukian, who is currently based in North Hollywood. Gev, you may remember, was a top 10 contestant on season 4 of So You Think You Can Dance, and very close friend of mine, and I've been very fortunate to have him come in and help us out with the show and the choreography in it. Also, Johnny Dessel, who was the United States swing dance champion when he was just 18 years old, has taken away his time and given us a substantial amount of knowledge and creativity that he's really plugged into the show. So I'd have to definitely take a moment to both thank and encourage everyone to come in to see some of these fantastic pieces.
It's really been a group effort. So many people has helped us out along the way. So thank you to everyone who's been a part of this wonderful project.
And then, of course, Kevin Palke, who's our technical director,
yes.
who is going so far out of his way to make sure that our set is exactly what we want and that we can get the lighting that we want and that we can really exhaust our possibilities as much as possible. I will never forget when we first presented this show to him and he just sat down with us and said, bring to me your biggest ideas and then we can work from there. And that's really been the mantra throughout this entire production. We're in a college and we're encouraged to collaborate with other majors and people with different perspectives and different ideas, which I believe helps us to create a show that's both unique and spectacular and something that we may not have seen before, but certainly something that presents something for everyone.
I'd like to thank both of you for taking the time to come in and help promote the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much, John.
That was John Sheldon with Lucas Manning and Jessica Ackerson. Through Wonderland runs through Sunday at Crafton Hills College. You're listening to KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Later, music and conversation with Stray Cat Lee Rocker. Next, though, Ron Burgless speaks with Paul Jacques about some regional, seasonal theater coming up soon. Paul is a very prolific person in the theater world in our region, and that was a natural place for Ron to start. Why not L.A. or New York? Why this region?
You know what? Riverside has been always a hub, as it were, where I can get anywhere quickly. And so that's been the main reason. The other reason is I've stuck around long enough to see a bunch of other groups pop up around the Inland Empire to work with. And so I've had no qualms about staying in the Inland Empire.
And you graduated from Riverside College, is that correct?
Yeah, you know, I'm a Riverside boy. I went to Ramona High School and then Riverside City College and then UC Riverside twice, undergraduate and graduate. You know, you've got a UC in your backyard. You've got all this other stuff. So yeah, it's been a good place to be.
So I started reading your resume at about 8 o'clock the other night, and by 12 o'clock I hadn't finished it yet. How many productions have you worked on since you graduated, do you think?
You know, I stopped counting at 200. I know there's that much on the resume. I don't know. Good grief. Maybe I should send the edited version over at some point. So yeah, just about 200.
Any favorites in amongst there? You really thought that was a great job. I did a great job there.
It's a great question. I would have to say that Sweeney Todd probably was one of my high points, my bright spots.
Where did you do that?
That was at UC Riverside, actually. They brought in Toby. He was Toby in the second national tour of Sweeney Todd. And a bunch of us just went there wanting to work with him. So that was kind of neat. Other than that, I did Forum over in Chino. A funny thing happened in the way to the Forum,
yep.
which is more fun than you should ever humanly be allowed to have on stage.
Didn't I hear that you're about to do that again?
Yes.
Okay, we'll get to that in a moment. Okay, but what I want to know is why directing? because you're a great actor, you've got some wonderful parts, but I also know that as a director, you've been incredibly successful. I think there's one theater that you worked at that you boosted the audience by 70%. That is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So why not pursue the acting as well?
I tend to gravitate towards directing because I can have more of an impact on more people. It's a wider canvas than just acting one role. With directing, I feel like...
Like you're playing all the parts?
You know what? Like I'm playing all the parts, but at the same time, you know, the way that I direct is really to empower the actor. I kind of give an overarching skeleton of what's supposed to happen, and then I allow them to kind of bring what they like, what they have in their toolkit to the roles so they feel like they have something invested. It's just kind of neat, whether it's professional cast, whether it's a student cast, it tends to work out the same. Because you as a director, you've got to worry about casting, you've got to worry about the scenic, you've got to worry about all these other elements of the show. But with directing, it's kind of neat to see these actors bringing so much to the table. And you kind of invest them in the role, and they come and they bring wonderful, wonderful stuff.
And you've also started theater companies, too. You've run your own companies, not just directed shows. You've directed whole companies. How many have you done? Where have you done them?
Well, the main one's in Riverside, and we have three theater company, and that's going to be this coming year at the Redlands Bowl. But that's mainly what that's turned into because I'm so busy the rest of the year being contracted out that I really only have time for about one homegrown production a year. Which is kind of a nice quandary to be in, that I have so many other responsibilities that I really only get to the one. But that one tends to be either something very, very artistic or something very, very commercial, one way or the other, which is kind of nice.
I saw one of your productions, the one you were company was above an antiques dealer. When you want to start a theater company, how did you find that venue, and how do you start choosing shows in order to be commercially successful?
We happen to be locked in with a couple of playwrights at UC Riverside, which is nice. That takes the guesswork out of it because they're spectacular playwrights. Chuck Everett, Robin Russin, a bunch of those guys up there. Then finding the space. The space is always the interesting question. They have the new box in downtown Riverside, and we're looking at that. But the found space stuff is really kind of interesting. It's like directing. It's like directing. You take a look at what can be rather than what is. That's Found Space Theater.
It's great. And you mentioned that you were going to be working at the Redlands Bowl, but you've already directed at the Redlands Bowl, haven't you?
Yes.
How many times have you done that?
This will be my third time.
Wow.
So,
how does that compare to working above an antiques dealer?
The Bowl is just incomparable as far as the size of the crowds, as far as the scope of the show. Just putting on something outside is tremendous by itself. You've also got to factor in that you're working with disadvantaged youth because they do an outreach that you can go and touch the lives of children that are out there. Man, it is so exciting to be out there and to look from behind the scenes and see just the panorama of people that are out there.
Yeah, and the crowds are huge. Yes. Like 3,000 people or something like
that? Oh, no. The crowds are 5,000 plus.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you also run the Ramona Festival, is that correct? Or you did?
I did.
And you've got something to do with the Dickens Festival as well?
10 years. 10 years as Charles Dickens, yeah.
Wow.
Coming up.
So all of that is incredible, and that should be enough.
Yeah.
But the fact is that your day job is that you teach. How many places do you teach at?
I teach at 4, plus I kind of cheat a fifth. I teach Cal Baptist, I teach at MSJC, I teach here, and I teach at Cal State San Bernardino, and then I cheat every once in a while at UC Riverside.
What do you teach here at Valley College?
Primarily, it's the intro class, it's the acting class, and then in the spring, I'll be teaching the scriptwriting course here that's an online course.
With Lindsay Wagner?
Yes, with Lindsay Wagner.
Great. How do you manage to teach at so many different colleges and direct the plays as well? When do you direct the plays? Like in your sleep, or when do you do that?
On autopilot, yeah. I've got a main line of RC Cola coming into my system. Those are at night. It just happens to work out. I teach during the day or on weekends, and then I teach, well, the online course, and then I direct at night.
You know, the Japanese have a saying that you don't truly master your craft until you teach it.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
I think that's incredibly insightful because I never thought of myself as a teacher, ever, ever. And I found that the more I taught something, the better I became at it. And it was kind of an odd sort of feeling that the more I had to explain something to someone, the more I understood it. And it was like an old voice coach said that there were opera singers who would come into his company and they would sing and they would try and teach. and they couldn't understand why nobody else could sing like they could sing. And the point was that he was supposed to go in and encourage the students to have breakthroughs and to learn how to sing, but they couldn't do it. And so the old Japanese saying is very, very true. I mean, anytime you have to break something down to its basics and get people from disparate backgrounds to understand it, it's much more understandable.
So what have you got coming up next?
I have coming up A Christmas Carol Over.
And this is not the first time that you've directed it, is it?
No, it is not the first time. It probably won't be the last time, but it is just fantastic. It's over at the Lewis Family Playhouse, opening in a couple of weeks, December 7th. We have an amazing cast. You know, we were supposed to do a pickup and go rehearsal last night with Act 1, kind of move our way through it. Got through the act twice, you know, so the cast is really, really involved in the show. They're very invested. So it's exciting to see another cast come in. You know, the tech people are freaking out. Oh, what are we going to do? How are we going to do this? You know, we don't have enough time. We're like, no, we're good. We're good. You tell us where to go and we'll be there.
I'm sure it's going to be amazing.
Yes.
And have you got plans for future productions after that?
Yes. It's a busy, busy spring. It is. I've got Funny Thing Happened in the Way to the Forum over at Mount Santa Center College. And we've got Hello Dolly coming up at Temecula Valley Players. And we have an untitled show. Yeah, got to wait for the announcement.
Oh, come on. come on. You can say it here. Come on. Nobody's going to know.
No, nobody except for your listeners. Yeah, it's nearly upon us, the announcement is, so.
Well, listen, it's been fantastic that you're able to come here tonight. It's been a real treat for me to sit here and find out more about you, your work in the theater, and your tireless devotion to the students of the Inland Empire. And ladies and gentlemen, if you want to give yourselves and your families a treat this coming holiday period, do yourselves a favor and go see Paul Jacques' production of A Christmas Carol at the Lewis Family Playhouse in Rancho Cucamonga.
It is the 7th through the 15th, so it's those 2 weeks over at Lewis Family Playhouse in Cucamonga. Parking over there is just a pain, but it's worth it.
I'm sure it will be. Thank you, Paul. I'm Ron Burgless, and you've been listening to KVC Arts.
Thank you, Ron. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcr.org. I'm David Fleming. Up next, Stray Cat Lee Rocker in Hemet. We're back in less than a minute.
Tune in for American Parlor Songbook. Join J.P. Houston at the piano for songs, stories, and sketches with me, his wife, Julie Van Dusen. J.P. sings the news, answers advice in song, and tells amusing tales. Recorded in front of audiences all over Southern California each week, with special guests dropping in to perform.
Monday evening at 7:30 on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming with you for KVC Arts, a program dedicated to arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. Now, Lee Rocker. He's performing at the historic Hemet Theater December 7th at 8 p.m. So with that in mind, depending on when you're listening, you can catch him tomorrow night or in just about 20 minutes. If it's the case of the latter, you might as well just hang out and listen. The story's the same. Many know Lee as a rockabilly performer, jumping around and yelling on stage, spinning a large upright bass. In essence, you know him as a bass player. Lee actually is a multi-instrumentalist and comes from a very musical family.
You know, I definitely grew up in a musical house. The one rule growing up is everyone in the house played music and studied and took lessons. So I started off on cello at about 6 or 7 years old and played cello for about 13 years. Moved to an electric bass, and then pretty quickly moved to upright bass. Both my parents are classical musicians. My dad was solo clarinet with the New York Philharmonic for 61 years.
Oh my.
He just retired. And my mom is a classical clarinetist as well, who has recorded and toured and everything for 60-some years also. They're alive and kicking and doing great.
Then your sister also, she's a singer-songwriter, I see.
She's out of Nashville, Roseanne Drucker, and she's great.
So music was then... Was it something that you then had a desire to learn with the fortune of nurturing parents? Or, as you said, hey, this is what happens in this house.
Oh, no, I wanted to. You know, I'm sure I dodged some of my lessons, you know, as a little kid. But once I started to play rock and roll, it was just all passion and what I wanted to do.
with you going to the Electric and all that, I'm thinking about the timing of this. Did you listen to Stanley Clark much at this point in your life?
I had heard him, of course. I can't say I spent a whole lot of time, but for a bass player, those years, Stanley was the guy, you know? I remember in the 70s and being a teenager, he was one of the guys on the map for certain.
Oh, yeah, totally. I got to talk to him not too long ago, and he used to say that the advice that he used to always give people were just simply buy school days.
Uh-huh.
But
I got to play with him once, actually, many years ago.
Oh,
did a TV show. I'm not remembering the name of the show, but Carl Perkins was involved, and there was like 30 musicians. And I know it was in L.A. Stanley Clark was on it, so was I, and we both took bass solos, and it was fun.
Yeah, it would have
It was a laugh. We had a good time doing it.
So let's talk about what was described as a slap-style percussive approach. Now, for someone just hearing your words, not being able to, if they see you on stage, and whether it's YouTube or in person or whatever, you can see that right away. But I wonder if you could put this into words, this slap-style, for someone just hearing this, not able to see you.
Well, you know, upright bass, so I play, you know, slap bass. I mean, there's a percussion aspect to it, you know, so it's part percussion, part bass. It's really both, and it really propels the music. So you can create different rhythmic patterns like you would on a drum, you know, whether it's a shuffle or a swing feel or a syncopation or, you know, really anything. It's really the heartbeat of rockabilly music is the upright bass. Bluegrass players, the same kind of thing. Upright bass really is the motor, you know?
Sure. Now, going way back when, I understand that you and Jim and Brian, they're all friends since grade school. When you and, I guess, James at first, well, Slim Jim, started playing together and eventually added Brian, was it already rockabilly at this point, or was this something that developed once you guys got together and started finding yourself?
Jim and I, and Brian as well, we all go back to elementary school knowing each other. So it's been a hell of a long journey. And musically, we all did, you know, everyone. We grew up in the suburbs in New York, and there was a lot of kids, teenagers, playing music, you know. We played all kinds of stuff. I always liked roots music. I was a big blues fan. I loved Chicago blues, Buddy Guy and Junior Wells and James Cotton and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, I can't speak for Brian or Jim, but, you know, I think we all kind of stumbled across rockabilly around the same time. I would haunt these record shops in New York City. I'd go in and, you know, obviously it was vinyl back then, and just go through these places and buy records with cool covers, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And then you'd get home and you'd put it on, and, you know, sometimes it'd be something you'd like, you know? There was also records at the public library, and some of those were early rock and roll records.
Yes.
Yeah. Nice. They had a Buddy Holly record and Johnny Cash record, and you could go to the library and get them for free, and it was like, wow, have you heard this, you know?
Suddenly, three-chord rock is so much more all of a sudden. Now, then, how about the look? Still talking about the Stray Cats, the decision or the realization, maybe, that you could mix a kind of a 50s look with whatever was going on in New York in the late 70s, early 80s.
Well, there was definitely a punk scene, you know, in New York, and we were playing rockabilly with our own energy and our own way of doing it in our time, you know? So we definitely brought that to it. I mean, it was the time of the Ramones, Blondie, you know, and we kind of absorbed a lot of that stuff, and I think it all came out. I mean, we were, you know, young kids. When the Stray Cats moved to London, together, the three of us, I was still 17, and we got thrown right in there with the Clash and the Pretenders and the rest of it, and everyone kind of influenced each other in a lot of ways.
And so how did you end up with that move to London to begin with? Was that simply because you were being courted by folks like Virgin or whomever the labels over there?
No, we weren't. We never thought that much, and especially at that time. What it was is it was June. I was 17 still. I was going to be 18 in August. And Ryan was maybe a year and a half older than me. Jim somewhere in the middle. We had been playing New York. We was at CBGB's and Max's Kansas City. And then we'd go up to Boston. We'd go down to Philly and play a lot in the suburbs also. And we would get these English music magazines at the time, these weeklies, Melody Maker or NME, which is the New Music Express. And it looked cool. It seemed like there was cool music going on there. So we just said, it's the summer. Let's save up some money from these shows, these bars we're playing, and go over there and see what happens. It really was that basic. Bought a seat for my bass. We bought four seats for the three of us, and we flew to London, not knowing anything. And we wound up knocking on doors, going to gigs, sleeping in a park or an all-night movie theater. And pretty quickly, though, things came together, I got to say. A couple of people gave us a break, let us come and play at different venues or pubs, and word spread pretty quickly. But I've got to say, the Stray Cats were a band that was the furthest thing away from something that is put together by a record company or a producer or anything.
You got that.
It was really a very, just grew up together and played my dad's garage and went to England, and record companies started showing up.
That's just cool. That's the way it's supposed to happen, or you hope it'll happen.
Yeah, I think it's a lot more real than going on some singing contest.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so while in London, here's something I'd like for you to clear up for me. There is something in the legend and lore out there regarding the name of the band, and it was either a circus or a movie poster?
Oh, yeah. We started off in New York. We called ourselves a lot of different names. Tomcats, Teds, we had all different names. So we moved to England. We really started to say, we better solidify and get a name that we stick with, you know. I came up with the name Stray Cats. We all agreed that that's great. That really works, you know. Within a few months, we had met Dave Edmonds, who became a record producer. Dave had a band, Rockpile, and was a great producer, worked with Elvis Costello and all kinds of people, as well as being a great artist himself. So he came down to some shows and invited us by his house to talk music and hang out and do whatever. We get to his house and we go down in the basement. He had a little kind of home pub there, and on the wall was a movie poster. I don't remember the name of the movie. And the band in the movie was called the Stray Cats. Dave was in that movie.
Gotcha.
So pretty strange thing. You know, it must be some kind of cult or little known thing, because I've never seen it again.
Well, I didn't know of it until Kurt mentioned it, and I had to get the real story from you on tape.
Right.
Something else pretty cool that he alluded to that I'd like to hear the real version of. Brian Setzer trying to show Eddie Van Halen some Travis-style picking. Eddie couldn't get it, and then you came along, you did it. Everybody's blowing away Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah, well, he does his thing, and that's rockabilly is not it, and he's a great player. But yeah, definitely, you know, what I do and what we do with the Stray Cats, it's a specific thing, not common knowledge.
Certainly. But I suppose by the same token, Brian may have a hard time doing the two-finger tap thing that Eddie has going.
You're absolutely right.
You ended up as part of the cast of Million Dollar Quartet on Broadway.
Right.
I read that you weren't cast per se, but rather you stepped in for a kind of a 12-run guest starring role. I'd like to hear about how this Broadway gig happened for you.
Million Dollar Quartet, it's about the day, I think in 1956, when Elvis Presley came back to Memphis and went to Sun Studio, and Johnny Cash was there, Jerry Lewis, Carl Perkins. And this play is based on that. And when I heard about the play, I bought a ticket and went down there to see it. And it was a great play. It was on Broadway for about a year and a half. But I loved the play. I thought they did a great job. It's only an 8-person play that's set in the studio. And there's the role of Carl Perkins' brother, who they called Jay. It was not his real name. For some reason, they didn't call him Clayton. The musical director is someone that I know over the years, Chuck Mead. So I called Chuck and I said, the play is great. We talked. He says, would you be interested in doing it? I said, absolutely, on a limited kind of thing. So I went in, did 2 weeks worth of shows on Broadway with that, and then continued. I spend part of my time in New York. So whenever I was in town, I'd say, hey, I'm coming in. You know, I'd love to do the Saturday. They'd go, you got it. You know, so I did this play, you know, a good maybe 20 times. And had a blast. It was one of those kind of bucket list things. I'd never really envisioned being on Broadway.
Yeah.
But it was a great experience.
Yeah, especially, I guess, being a New Yorker. I mean, you grow up, whether or not that's your thing, that is being an actor as opposed to anything else one might do in their life, you can't be in New York without thinking about Broadway and all those people
that
are there.
Yeah, and I'm not an actor, but the role was a bass player at Sun Studio. I wasn't cast to be an astronaut in Apollo 16, you know, so this was right up my alley.
Right.
And Carl Perkins was a friend of mine. I loved Carl. We worked together a lot over the years. It meant a lot to me to help tell his story, and a lot of this play is Carl Perkins' story. Most of the world knows about Johnny Cash and Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis. Most people don't know about Carl Perkins, and it really focuses on him. So I was happy to be up there and be his brother.
Let's move on to the cover sessions. One of the things you said, it's not a good way to get things done, but you like the perspective it gives you, and it's not a race anyway. Because we're talking about you recording something, stepping away for a few weeks. Mark Twain would call that pigeonholing it. Mm-hmm. How does this help or perhaps change your perspective to be able to just step back and reexamine?
I find sometimes, and things just come out how they come out sometimes, but that record, because I played so many instruments on it, I was a little bit isolated, as opposed to every other record I've done in my career where there was more of a band of people doing it, either a proper band or different musicians. This one, it was a little bit tunnel vision in the sense that I played a lot of the instruments. Not all of them, but the vast majority. So I would be overdubbing a lot. And it just helped me to be able to record a couple of parts, put down bass and acoustic guitar and some mandolin or ukulele or auto harp or whatever it is and do some percussion, and then leave, kind of not listen to it constantly every day and come back and get a grasp of it. And it is different because it let me get perspective, as I said, and not be so inside it always. And I needed to do it that way. And it's also, you know, you kind of get lonely there in the studio by yourself, you know, so it's like no one to talk to but me and my engineer, you know, for days on end. So that record, I think there's 6 songs on that. It's really an EP. I started with many more songs and edited it down as to what I was really enjoying, what I thought worked well. And the songs I picked for it were songs that I grew up with, hearing them on the old AM radio. So it's Come Dancing, The Kinks, yeah. Ramblin' Man, City of New Orleans. It's stuff that's kind of really stuck in my mind because I heard them when I was 14, 15, 16 so much.
So were these then songs that, let's say, for example, my two favorites on that, where you really give it your own sound. I mean, they're all really cool, but my two favorites would have to be Come Together and Honky Cat.
Yeah, I think those are probably the most successful versions in a way.
And it's got that really cool boom chicka thing going. So I'm wondering then if some of these things, just take Come Together, for example, is this something that you've always mulled around in your mind or decided I'd love to arrange it like this someday? You also mentioned that you were sort of picking up instrument after instrument, that is collecting them, buying things
sure.
that you thought were cool. And so it came about that way.
I don't even know what came first,
gotcha.
To tell you the truth. I did start to collect all kinds of instruments, mandolins, ukuleles, auto harps, 6-string guitars, 12-string guitars, nylon guitars, harmonicas, had this tremendous amount of stuff. And if it's got strings, I have fun playing it, and I can figure out a lot of things with strings relatively quickly. Although I'd never played a mandolin before or a ukulele, played a lot of guitars, a lot of basses. So I just sat down in the studio and started to mic them up and listen to the tone and play things, and it sort of evolved into, I didn't have a whole lot of songs I had written at that point for that reason. I just went in and started to play songs that were stuck in my mind over the years.
Nice. Okay. Yep. On this one, again, it worked out great for me since we're close to the same age. These are the same songs that I ended up with on in my AM radio history.
Take that night train to Memphis, take that night train to Memphis. When you arrive at the station, well, I'll be right there to greet you, I'll be right there to meet you. Don't turn down my invitation. Take that night train to Memphis, take that night train to Memphis.
Night Train to Memphis, again, a lot of covers there, but it's not like, you know, all these well-known tunes. We've got the Everly Brothers, but not, say, Kathy's Clown or some of their biggest
right.
stuff. Buddy Holly, Hank Sr., Elvis, Bill Monroe, of course, the Stray Cats tune, Built for Speed, my first album. My first Stray Cats album.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, you described as classics from the early days with the Lee Rocker Stray Cat stamp on them. More importantly, you also described this album as the soundtrack to your life. If you could please elaborate on this statement.
Night Train to Memphis, the songs there are really what is the soundtrack of my life. It's the stuff that just has stuck with me and moved me from the first time I heard it. It's also a collection of songs that I've played my whole life at just about every concert. I mean, certain things come and go, but those are real staples for me. And I went in the studio, actually the opposite experience of the cover sessions was Night Train to Memphis. This record, I went in the studio with my band, Buzz Campbell, Brophy Dale, and Jimmy Sage, And we set up in one room like they used to do. No isolation, no little glass walls or anything. We sat around more or less in a circle. We mic'd the instruments and we played live. And that record was recorded in about 3 days and mixed in probably about 3 days. So that was 1 week on that record. So that's truly the old school way of doing it. No modern technology of any consequence on there. No auto-tune, which they use for singers nowadays, and ways to fix mistakes or anything. This is just us sitting around playing like we do every day. And it was a blast to get back to that way of doing it, also, I have to say. And you capture a realness that way, and that sort of spirit stays on it.
Now, with performances nowadays, of course you want to do the new stuff, any album you may have just released, but there's also got to be a heavy Stray Cats presence. It's like,
oh,
okay,
yeah.
Here's the Stray Cats thing.
You know, music from throughout my career, so I'm definitely playing a bunch of Stray Cats stuff, and things from my solo records and classic rockabilly and rock and roll, whether it originated from Carl Perkins or Buddy Holly or Elvis Presley as well. But I'd definitely do Rock This Town and Stray Cat Strut, 1617, and a whole bunch of them.
So with all this history, this may be a far-fetched question, but what goes into putting together a set list for you nowadays? Try to go upbeat, upbeat, down, upbeat, upbeat, you know, and it goes from there, or do you start with, this is what everybody wants to hear, and then surround it like that?
Yeah, I mean, there's certain songs that I know I'm going to play every night, because, you know, I want to play them and people want to hear them. And that, of course, is some of the big Stray Cat hits. And then it's just a matter of fun and mood, you know. I mean, the band has been with me, some of them, for 15 years. And I think the newest guy, 8, 9 years. So we can move things around and have fun. I usually come up with a list and then just call them out after that if I'm just feeling something different that night.
What is your favorite from Night Train to Memphis? I have to say Slap That Bass has a great feel, kind of like Look at That Cadillac way back when, but just a fun jump swing kind of sound.
Yeah, I mean, I like the whole record, but Slap That Bass, Rockabilly Boogie, and probably the title track, Night Train to Memphis.
Nice. What do you do in your off time when you're away from music?
You know, it's pretty much music-based always. I'm always writing, rehearsing. You know, I've been having a lot of fun lately with the website and the social media, the Facebook stuff, which is LeeRocker.com, and The Stray Cat Lee Rocker is the Facebook page. I've got a studio at my house. We've loaded with cameras and been doing some unplugged sessions and putting them on the web on the Facebook. So that's occupied a lot of time. And it's a lot of fun just to sit down with my friends, play some music, and put it out.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, no filters. It's great. You just go.
That's perfect. It's the most real.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when you
record
this...
a song, you film it, and 10 minutes later, it's available to people, and, you know, it's kind of instant gratification, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's great for you and for the folks that are anxiously awaiting more and more material, so this is great for everybody involved.
But, excellent.
Lee, thank you very, very much for your time, and I can't wait for this live presence.
All right. Well, thank you.
Stray Cat Lee Rocker at the historic Hemet Theater tomorrow night at 8. That's going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts, dedicated to arts and entertainment in our region and the people and places providing it. Thanks to Ron Burglis, Elena Villa, Paul Jacques, Lucas Manning, and Jessica Ackerson here at KVCR. Thanks to Lindsay Weisgarver, Shaylin Blaney, John Sheldon, and program coordinator Rick Dulock. Thanks also to Lee Rocker for sending me the music you've been hearing in the background. His latest releases are Night Train to Memphis and The Cover Sessions. Other themes and beds, Behind Us Now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. And thanks especially to you for listening. I'm David Fleming. This is 91.9 KVCR San Bernardino Riverside, streaming online at kvcr.org. We're a service of the San Bernardino Community College District. It's 9 o'clock.